All right, so we're going to go back to 2 weeks ago, not last week, but 2 weeks ago. And the big question from 2 weeks ago was exactly how does the gospel spread? What was it that Jesus had in mind? What was God's plan for the spread of the gospel? And how do you transmit a message across borders, across cultural boundaries and all that? And we said that there's several things that the early church had to go on. There's several things that they relied on. Does anybody remember what they were? Okay, well, the first was they had the Old Testament law. The next one was Jesus' teachings. Then they moved on to the apostles' words, teachings, interpretations of what Jesus said. And then there was one final thing, and that was experience. How did people experience the gospel? So, as the Holy Spirit shows up and people are transformed, as people experience the miraculous or see the miraculous, they buy into the gospel. Now, do you remember what we said was the challenge of this? That if you were a Jew, you knew this well, right? But as the gospel spread out into Gentile territory, what happens? That's less relevant. That's less effective. There's no foundation there for people to build their new understanding on. So they rely more on this and this and that. And that becomes the challenge. How does the gospel spread? And then how does it spread? This is hard enough when you're spreading a message within the same culture. Then we said, how does the gospel spread across cultures? Language barriers, perceptions about the way we do life. How does the gospel spread across that? And we said that there was one overarching word that served all of that, and it was love. And that's why love was so important. We've defined love countless times, but we'll do that one more time. Love is I've given you a nice, crisp, concise definition multiple times. Anybody remember? The active and intentional looking out for the best interest of another person. Actively and intentionally looking out for the best interest of another person. So the only way that the gospel message really spreads, because who has interest in it? Why would I give up what I already have in favor of something else? Unless there's something to be gained, right? Because aren't we all consumers? Aren't we all serf-oriented, at least initially? Right? Hopefully that changes over a period of time, but why do you go buy the car that you buy? It's a good buy, or you like the way you look in it, or whatever. You do it for you. Okay, so how do you teach this gospel message to people who don't have a foundation? So Jesus summed it up. We looked at, in Deuteronomy, Moses' summation of it. Love God, love others. Love God, love your neighbor. And then we defined what a neighbor is. Remember we said that if you were in first century Palestine and you were, let's say, in Jerusalem, for the most part, you would have been surrounded by at least some Jewish neighbors. Well, at least up to a point, we find it easier to love those who are like us. We understand them. We can get them. But what happens when the person who lives next door to you is Roman and they're part of the occupying force? What happens when the person who lives next to you is actually hostile to you? So when Jesus said that you should love your neighbor, what he's talking about is literally whoever is next to you, whoever is in front of you, you should actively look out for the best interest of the person who's right there in front of you. That means that today, 50% of the time, you're going to be looking out for the best interest of someone who may not like you. They're not like you. They may not like you. And we're not inclined to do that. That's why this is so transformational. That's why it's so revolutionary. And that's why the gospel really doesn't take root well for any length of time. Don't you and I, and I'm going to give you floor space then, don't you and I struggle to love people that we don't like? I mean, it's just not natural. Jim?
I just had this discussion with my wife.
Uh-oh. Who was doing the talking and who was doing the listening? Jim. I'll bet she was. Or at least you think she was.
When the Germans poured across the borders, it was white guys fighting white guys. And during the Revolutionary War, it was white guys fighting white guys. There was no race involved. It was an ideological separation the whole time. There wasn't. You know, we would have been. That's fine. But you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I
agree. It's white guys fighting white guys. Racist thing. It was an ideological thing. The Rome thing. You know what I mean? Rome kept them severely oppressed. You know, they were, this was difficult. It was hard. And what do? You love your way out of it? I think for some of them they did. But for others, they fought back.
Is this all regular? I'm sorry. Is this all regular?
Well, yeah.
Sorry. But for others, they fought, at least through their ground, we'll say, you know, and said, no, it's not how we do it, it's not how we live. And it's not okay for you to do that either. And at some point, what had to happen is the leader of the Roman, you know, people had to start to go, oh yeah, you know what I mean? When whatever it was, Constantine or whatever, the leader was like, you know what, that makes sense. And it shifted an entire, you know what I mean? They watched how we interact. I'm not going to use the term Christians because they weren't really, it wasn't even that. Even then, you know, the term was used very loosely. It's sort of called, I don't know, it's Christian. But it was a group of people who so loved one another, that took care of one another. And people looked at that and went, man, even in these times, they're selling their land and giving it to those guys, and they're feeding her kids. And they, man, that, why? You know what I mean? And it's ideological. It's not, it just, when he says go for two, first mile, you don't have to be happy. Second mile, just because.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And there,
but there's a transformation that has to take place in a human heart before you're willing to even do that.
Right, but that's the whole point, is the guy at the top of that empire had to go, hey, you know what? He's right. And until then, there was still this just, you know what I mean? There has to be a dramatic transformation at the top for something like that to happen.
But since that's normally, okay, so
I was thinking that because I don't want to turn this into some crazy, like, political thing.
It's too late.
But when I heard the Attorney General say we have to fight this thing with love and compassion and kindness, I'm thinking, you don't even understand what they want, do you?
Yeah, she had no program.
And so, my point being is that the Roman Empire wanted to rule the world. Hitler wanted to rule the world, the entire earth. At some point, you have to stop that. And you teach what you teach. You hold on to your ideology, but just like Christ said, you stand your ground.
Yeah, but like he was just saying, it does work in a small scale. We can love each other. I can turn you to the cheek. But on a large scale, it doesn't work, right?
But people see us, and then they start to ask, wait a minute, they just had a disagreement. I would have hit them in the face. But they had a nice debate. They argued their points. Then they both agreed to not have a fight. They agreed to say, you know what? You're right. I see your point. But here's what I believe. Yeah, you know, you're right, but here's what I believe. And so oftentimes, it's not like that. There's this overarching need to make you believe what I believe. And I think what happens in church is the overarching need to make you believe what I believe without the love part.
And sooner or later, this is what it all gets down to. Remember, we had the discussion about doctrine versus experience, and we said that doctrine is necessary because if we don't agree on any terms of what's right and wrong, we're in trouble. But experience is also necessary because if all we believe is a collection of rules and regulations about how to treat each other, but we have no experience of why that's good for us, then we're not going to follow the doctrine for very long anyway.
And you have to know the doctrine because when they ask why you believe...
Right. You have to know
the doctrine. You can't influence anybody. They think they should
You have to know the doctrine. But remember, now we move. I had that list up there before: the law, the teachings of Jesus, the interpretations of the apostles, the experience, etc. The further away you move from that law, the more difficult it is for people to understand and embrace why the law is good. So the only way that they will ever discover that the law is worth considering is if the love that they experience is compelled by our understanding of what the law says lived out.
How long do you think of that? On a small scale, again, you can do that, but when you hear the government people saying we're supposed to love the terrorists, you have to show that love, right? That what the Attorney General says?
Yeah. Show who love?
The Muslims and the terrorists.
Okay.
She said that the other day. I was just absolutely astounded that she would even think about doing something like that when they're just... I'm sorry, they're
helping
on coming here and killing us.
Not all of them.
Right.
Not all of them. Not all of them. Right. It's okay. I love Muslims. I love the ideology of the moderate Muslim people that aren't all about death and destruction and the caliphate and all of that stuff. Because they're essentially the same. Love God, love people, help your neighbor. A lot of the, I think what helps us is that the law, and then you drag that down, and when you can correlate your law with the law of the people that they have, and you can do this with it and show them where it works together, how it works, why it essentially does work, but that maybe you see differently because of your life experience. Maybe you visited differently.
Okay, he asked a good question, though, that deserves an abrupt answer, I think. What are the options? What are the other options?
Where do you draw the line? If we're sitting here trying to tell each other where we have to show love and compassion to each other.
Wait, we don't have to. That's the critical thing.
That's what we want. That's where we had the analogy earlier.
We're supposed to do
as consumers. Yeah, exactly. And that's the right way to do things, I believe. Now. But now when I hear her say that, and how do we feel about these therapists? Can each one of us sit here and say, you know what, she's right. We should love those people. Where do you draw the line where you know what, enough's enough? Even in small scale or in large scale, as a believer, what do you guys believe? How do you feel about that terrorist
thing? I can tell you that for me, I had this argument when I first got saved. I had this argument with myself, and I had this argument with God. I tried to become a super spiritual dude. I really tried to become, I don't even know what you want to call it, you know what I mean? I really tried to be Mr. Super Spiritual, and everything's about this. I had a real, first got out of there, I was like, I can't do this. And he said, I never asked you to. I needed a warrior. I got plenty of those guys. I need the guy that's going to stand up for the guy that doesn't have a voice and is going to say, talk to him like that again, I'm going to feed your teeth. You put your hands on him, and I'll knock you out. I'll introduce you to Jesus right now. Don't do that. Don't do that. Don't think that you're going to come in here and run over us just because we're all about love, peace, kindness, goodness. Don't think that you're going to do that. Because I'll knock you out right where you stand. I love those guys who are in the MMA rings, and it's sport.
Okay, so there is a compound answer to your question. In the law, the government is instituted by God in order to act on behalf of the people. So it is improper for individuals to take upon themselves the role of revenge or whatever that the government is supposed to. So the government is supposed to do certain things, and that's why if government leaders are not committed to righteousness, in other words, if they don't study God's principles, they're going to act on their own impulse. Right? And we see that from one extreme to the other, from Germany that now opens up its borders to everyone because that's the loving thing to do, to people at the other extreme that kill just about anybody.
However, it does say the brethren first. You care for the brethren first. You make sure that the brethren, i.e. UK, no, we're going to take care of our guys first, the brethren first, because I can't take care of you. It's the old saying in recovery, never get out of the boat. Throw the life preserver 1,000 times, but never get out of the boat.
Okay, so we're actually going to get to that verse, that specific verse. But, so government has certain roles, people have certain roles. So as an individual human being, I probably don't have the right to go and take revenge on something myself. That doesn't mean I don't take a stand for something.
Well,
love is misunderstood. Love has to have a forceful side to it as well.
And our government isn't based on Christianity or the Bible anymore, correct?
Well, it certainly was founded on biblical understanding. It has drifted very far afield from that by now.
But when you have 600 laws, it's easy to get lost.
Well, that's why, okay, Brother Jim, if you would ever let me return to the direction that I was headed in 15 minutes ago, we might get somewhere. As you move further and further away from everybody having an understanding of the law, what are you reduced to? You need to have a capsulized version of the law that you can teach everyone, that can give them guidelines for how you do this. In other words, if I come from Jerusalem and I'm one of Jesus' followers and I knew Jesus and I share the gospel message with Jim, who's Jewish, but didn't have face-to-face interaction. Maybe Jim is a Jew who lives in Egypt or a Jew who lives in Rome or something. So I travel to Rome. Jim and I have this in common. We both believe the law. We both understand that there is one God. We both believe that there is a coming Messiah. And so I tell Jim that I have seen and experienced the Messiah. He has come and he... And Jim has a choice to embrace that. But now Jim goes out and he wants to share this good news. But now the people that are his neighbors are not all Jews. And so as Jim goes to share this, his foundation has got to be smaller. So how does he communicate this to those people that he's going to communicate it with? It's love the Lord your God, love your neighbor as yourself.
Yeah, and it's so much easier with I watch it happen than I know a God. Because that guy says, yeah, I know a God who saw him. And his neighbors go, so what? He's got to have legitimate proof of, okay, so explain it to me. Then show me proof. Well, the guy who says, I saw Jesus, has to be able to say, he did this. Wow.
Well, we often forget the second part of Paul's statement. We're very familiar with what Paul says, that we're ambassadors of Christ, right? We quote that a lot, but we don't tend to focus as much on the second part where he says, as if Christ were making his case through us, which means that somehow we literally become the mouthpiece of God. That's the cool thing, because God gives us the flexibility. How can I best represent the gospel to you in a way that you will understand it, given that you don't have the same foundational understanding that I do? All right, so we just had an interesting political discussion about the European Union. Now imagine having that discussion with a 7-year-old. It would be a little bit tough, right? They wouldn't have a basic foundation in finance and governance and all that that would make that conversation meaningful. Well, it's the same way when we go to present the gospel to people. It doesn't mean that they're dumb, but they are ignorant of certain things that are essential if you're going to, for instance, the whole concept of the fact that A, is there a God? B, are we separated from Him? Does God just love anybody and everybody indiscriminately, or are there certain assumptions that we have to make about how to relate to God? Well, if the people that I'm sharing the gospel with don't understand or believe the same things, what Jesus is saying is there's only one language that they get. Love them. Even if they act as if they are your enemy, love them, because it is the only language through which God can attempt to reach their hearts and through that communicate what love really is and how much God loves them. So your words don't matter as much as your actions in that case. Just find ways to love them. My brother Jim, I believe you probably have argued against everything else. You not only can, you not only have the raw and latent capability to do that, I believe you have done so. But that leads us to the next challenge. And this is what I believe happens. Have you ever watched a kid with toys? Right, so here's the kid. And he starts out the day and he sees a toy here. So he runs to the toy, picks up the toy, plays with the toy, discards it and runs on to the next one, to the next one, to the next one. Right? And there's a stream of stuff. And that's sort of the way at times Christian community looks. See, it's easy to get excited about loving somebody new because there's the hope of presenting the gospel to them. They're a project. And we love them for a period of time because they're a project, and maybe we're going to be the one that wins them to Christ and all that. But what happens if we leave a trail of carnage behind us? In the sense that we don't continue to love the people that we are already in relationship with. Okay, so it's one thing to love somebody for a little while. It's another thing to love somebody once we finally get to the point that we discover we really disagree with them. Let's turn over to Romans. We're going to use Romans 14 and 15 for a lot of the time. And while you're turning over to Romans 15, I want to read this one verse from Proverbs. It's on your sheet. Whoever pursues righteousness and kindness will find life, righteousness, and honor. Now that seems like such a simple proverb. I'm convinced it's in there because it's so hard to do both at the same time.
Read that again, Proverbs.
Whoever pursues righteousness... It's on your paper if you'd like to read it.
Okay.
Whoever pursues righteousness and kindness will find life, righteousness, and honor. So you're going to do two things. In return, you're going to get three things back. It seems like just a nice milquetoast sort of a saying. But how hard is it to pursue both of those things at the same time?
Early in my recovery, I still remember Blake. I lived down in North Carolina. He told me, it's always better to be kind than right. You can be the whitest, loneliest person in the world. He says, if you're kind, you'll have another shot at getting them to recovery. But if you're just consumed with being right, telling them how wrong they are, they'll leave and probably never come back.
Well, yeah, you gotta bring people along slowly. I mean, when you're starting to establish a relationship, you can't just go, and everything that you said makes sense. All of you, you know. You can't just go throwing a Bible at somebody and go, here you go. They see your actions, they see how you treat other people. I think sometimes it's a real slow process. You can't just go dumping them, throwing up on them. You've got to bring people along slowly. It's just like establishing a, you know, a new neighbor moves in. You go introduce yourself and pretty soon you learn about each other. Hey, can you watch my house this weekend? I'm going away. And it grows. I think it's very rare the person that you sit down with and say, okay, I'm a Christian. This is what I believe. And they're jumping right into it.
Okay, well, just stop and let's think about what this really is saying. It says, whoever pursues. So to pursue means that the person pursuing believes that they have the power to obtain whatever it is. Can I pursue your righteousness? Of course not. I can't make him be good. I can pursue kindness toward him. There's only one person's righteousness that I can pursue. It's my own. That's it. So while I am pursuing my internal righteousness, I am pursuing at the same time kindness toward you. Especially in the face of things that I feel personally that you may not be doing righteously. And that is the thing that brings this threefold return. It's not me imposing my law on you. It's me imposing my law on me and doing that with excellence. And you're going to observe the difference, right? He's going to see that I somehow live differently, talk differently, whatever differently.
You are, how, you know, careful you are about how you talk and what you do and how you interact with other people. You know, how come you're so...
But I'm not going to impose my standard of language on Jim. I'm not going to impose my standard of behavior on Jim. I'm going to impose my kindness on Jim. Which is the only thing that's likely to break the ice with Jim and allow him to say, I'm at least intrigued by who you are. So whenever we attempt to, and we do this all the time, when I attempt to impose my righteousness on you, it all goes sideways in a hurry. And so let's look at the three things that it gets us. All right, it says life, righteousness, and honor. So how do we end up with life as a result of that? Well, what kind of life is it to constantly be going around being someone else's police person? I mean, think about it. When I'm so busy worrying about your behavior and what annoys... Have you ever been in a conversation with people who are always complaining about those people out there? Other people? We all do that. Why? Because it's so hard to work on ourselves. Given a choice on any given day, it's much easier to complain about the people out there and how the world would be a better place if the people out there would only do their part than it is to really look inside ourselves and ask this question: have I really done all that I am capable of doing today given the resources that God has given me here and now? Have I fully utilized what God has given me to be the best person that I can be before I pass any judgment on you?
If we did, we would have exceeded ourselves.
Yeah, I think so. Now, remember what we've said when we started out. We said that we're typically consumers. Why would I want for myself what isn't working for you? Like, why would I want for myself... I mean, I'm already... maybe not happy with myself. The last thing I want to add to who I am is to be a judgmental creep like you are on top of that. So I'd rather just stay the way I am, and you can keep your judgmental creepyism.
You gotta be careful, because that's what's going on right now. We're the judgmental creeps, and we're being horrible people because we think that, you know what, maybe we should slow down for a second. Let's reset the machine and see where it goes. Oh, you're racist, you're judgmental, you're xenophobic, you're all those things. And they do that. This is what people do. They start casting labels and calling, they call you something. And now you spend so much time trying to explain why you're not that. When they could just look at you and go, man, I really want to call him a racist, but he's not. Why?
Yeah.
Hanging out with my black friend.
Yeah.
And making sense. So it's hard.
Okay, so in the end, we obtain life. We keep our righteousness. And I want to emphasize it that way. We keep our righteousness because, really, I'm not particularly righteous if I'm spending all of my time judging you. Imposing my righteousness that really isn't fully formed on you is not making me more righteous. As a matter of fact, what it's doing is trying to make me feel good because my arbitrary standard of rules and regulations that you don't meet makes me feel good about myself.
But what do they call it when you're overly that way? It's not self-righteous. It's self-righteous.
Yeah. And in the end, you get honor. In the end, you actually get the respect of other people. That's interesting. Simple observation. Okay, Romans 15, start of the chapter. It's interesting that both 14 and 15 sort of start the same way, but we're going to start at the beginning of 15. We who are strong ought to bear with the failings of the weak and not to please ourselves. Each of us should please his neighbor for his good, to build him up. For even Christ did not please himself, but as it is written, the insults of those who insult you have fallen on me. And that's a pretty interesting... Do you see what that statement says? Here's what Christ did. Christ acts like a big umbrella. So when the outside world is throwing insults at us, Christ stands in the middle, he says, and I'll take those insults for you. Now usually, what happens when we're watching somebody else be insulted? It doesn't take long before we jump on the bandwagon. Instead of us acting as umbrellas, were you going to finish that? Or are you waiting for the donut to...
I don't get next to that guy and say, hey, shut your mouth. You don't get to do that. And then he looks at me like I'm some kind of... No. You're being an a-hole. Knock it off. And there's not enough of that today, because now all of a sudden I'm in fear of a lawsuit or some sort of thing because I'm defending someone.
Well, do I care about that? That's what righteousness stands for. Do I care about that? If my personal reputation is defamed because I take up the cause of the weak, champion the cause of the person who doesn't have a voice of their own,
persecuted.
And I will be.
So if you go on two ways, it is easy. It's much easier to do what you said. It's easier. Yeah. Jump on that wagon.
All right, let's keep on reading. The insults who insult you have fallen on me. For everything that was written in the past was written to teach us so that through endurance and the encouragement of the Scripture we might find hope. May the God who gives endurance and encouragement give you a spirit of unity among yourselves as you follow Christ Jesus. Let me just read the beginning of chapter 14. You don't need to turn there. Accept him whose faith is weak without passing judgment on disputable matters. And again, I'll read the first line of chapter 15. We who are strong ought to bear with the failings of the weak. It's almost the same thing said, but in a slightly different way. So I started to ask myself, what exactly is it that Paul is talking about here, and why is it so important? Two chapters in a row. What does he know that we ought to know so that we could understand this? And I think he's maybe intentionally vague about this. In chapter 14, he talks about all the things that are dividing, let's say, Jews from Gentiles, what they eat, what they don't eat, what they drink, what they don't drink, important days, non-important days, all these things that can divide us. He says that we need to get beyond that stuff. Well, what are the things that divide us today? Remember what I said, you have to keep the community that you have. Otherwise, you become like the kid who we illustrated before. We have to keep the families we've built. Otherwise, wherever we go, we leave carnage behind us and wreck relationships as we pursue the next ones. The first days of a marriage are always easy, generally speaking, because in the first days of a marriage, you haven't had any major, major blowouts. What keeps a marriage together for years? Is you learn how to process the blowouts, you learn how to process the disagreements, and move on beyond there and find some common ground.
Well, you said earlier, you learn how to play someone else's, whatever it is, above your own. You learn how to do that. That's not a child. A child doesn't do that. You have to learn how to do that. Children are selfish. By nature, they're selfish. And you have to teach someone how to be righteous. They don't know how to be righteous. They don't know what they're looking for. They're running around lost just like everybody else. And so you have to teach that. Teaching righteousness is difficult, though. It's a hard thing to teach because you must face that fact.
Teaching righteousness as rules doesn't work. Teaching righteousness as acts of love works. Okay, so why is there such resistance? Why was there such resistance to, let's say, we'll go back to the 60s, right? What's wrong with the, if you can't be with the one you love, love the one you're with, right? That's 60s era mentality. What's wrong with that? Right, but if all it is a form of righteousness, rigid righteousness imposed on people, they resist it. The only way that that looks like something good is if people get to see and experience what it's like when you actually have a rich relationship with one person. Do you understand what I'm saying? Unless the product that you want to sell is better than the one that they already have, they're going to just keep the one they have. Why would I want one relationship?
That turned into something that wasn't. That turned into sex for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
That's the feel good. That's not love. That's the feel good. Love is so different than that. Love is, you know what? She was mean to me this morning, and I left that way. I'll take her to dinner tonight. I'm not going to be a jerk. Just go home and sit down for the TV. We're going to do, you know what I mean? Like, I'm going to act as if, you know what? Bad day. I'm going to believe the best and not just assume the worst. The other one is just the feel good. And then when the fuel good stops, I'll go get another one. And then when the fuel good stops, I'll go get another one. See what I'm saying? When the fuel good stops, others. You discard it. People are disposable, essentially.
Wait, you're not trying to convince me. I already...
But that's what ends up happening with the love thing. You throw the word around, and then you actually find out that that person isn't like that at all, but that they treat people as if they're disposable. And oftentimes today, we treat people as if they're disposable. You know what I mean? I said to a boss of mine once, I said, how many customers become inconvenience? Oh, you're my lip. I'm so busy on my... Your thumbs are so busy. How can I possibly help you? And it just goes back to, you know, love your neighbor, love the brethren, do that first. And if you do that, you're righteous and kind. You changed the world. It did, at one point, change the world. It'd be nice if we could get back to that. Where? When I saw something on the street.
You need to make up your mind. Are you staying or are you going? And what's your going?
We got back to a time where when I saw something happen on the street, I could go over and knock that guy out. And when the cop showed up, I could say, you know what he was doing? He was doing this. And they go, hey, buddy, you're coming with us. And how'd they take me to jail? How'd they take me to jail? It's crazy. Hopefully we can return. Get back to the garden.
There he goes.
Is he done? He's not wrong. What are the things that divide us? It's a big question. What are the things that divide us today? Okay, so they're looking at divisions as what you eat or don't eat, what you drink or don't drink, are there special days or not special days, and the list goes on. What are the things that divide us today? Well, let's make a... Go ahead.
Politics. It's probably the biggest thing right now.
Okay.
Religion.
Define that.
It's a lack of...
Okay. Anything else?
Economic.
Ooh.
What was that, Jason? Economic standing.
Anything else?
As little as opinions.
All right. Go into a room of 1,000 people and start to sort people out by that. How many different camps would there be by the time you ran everybody through all those filters?
Much.
There would be.
Absolutely.
There would be. So here's the first premise that I have about this. Disagreements are the breeding ground for argument, for the loss of love, for the disconnect that causes me to go my way and you to go yours. What is a disagreement?
Points of view.
It's something that you and I do not share in common. Here's the amazing thing. I have in theory, we're going to call this a perfectly white board, right? So if I put one red dot in the middle of the white board, what do you notice?
It's not a perfectly white board anymore.
You notice the one thing, right? We are conditioned to, and by nature just tend to notice, the thing that is not like us or not natural or not normal for us. We notice the red dot, not the white board. Our tendency as humans is to notice the things that we disagree with others about. So until I get to know you better, all I know about you is what I don't agree with you about and what I don't like about you. We were having this discussion last night. I said, what is it that gives people such boldness behind a quarter inch of glass to be able to flip you the bird when they wouldn't do that in person? What is it about that? Well, what do they know about me at that moment? They know that I've done something that didn't agree with their way of driving. Or I impeded their progress, or somehow, I don't know, I didn't use my turn signal or whatever I did. They don't... Go ahead.
That comes back to your love thy neighbor thing right there. That's where I get... As soon as you walk out these doors, you're fighting that. And that right there is a perfect example. How many times in your job did you get a situation where you could just flip out? I don't know if I'm explaining myself right, but
you're making exactly the perfect point. There's days I still wish I had my ticket book. But you know what? Just let it go, man.
Yeah, just let it go.
It's not worth it.
It's not your ticket book you miss, it's your gun.
Oh. So that's what it is. It's just let it go, right? And let them deal with that sort of problem. Right? Randy Chalker and I get there. He'll drive on to work. He calls me and he goes, I got to talk to someone. I'll do the same thing. I'm stuck in traffic, dude. I need to talk to you, you know? So, and it works, you know, for all word at them, I guess, but it's a constant battle to love thy neighbor, you know. And when do they stop being your neighbor? When
there is some sort of separation that you can create, right? It's why I'm convinced people can be rude in crowds, they can be artificially bold in crowds. It's much more difficult. Look at things that occur on the internet, right? People take cheap snipes at each other in posts and Twitter posts and comments on blogs where they'll make cheap comments. The kind that they'd be far less likely to make if they were face to face. So if I were to actually treat everybody as if I were face to face with them, even if I wasn't face to face with them, it would help to temper my comments a little bit. But I'm convinced of this also, and you brought up this. How do we do this is your question. I think you have to be with other people who are committed to doing this and be with them often enough that it offsets the influence that you get everywhere else in life. So just think about, how many hours a week are you at work? 65? Okay. Now, I don't know where you work or who you work with or what. Do you work with other people?
I do.
Okay. You?
I'm in traffic all day.
You're in traffic all day? What do you do?
Drive.
Okay. Oh, my word. We become, I believe, like the people that we are with most of the time. It's inescapable. I start to think like them. I start to talk like them. It's for good and for bad. But it's just what we do. Now, what if the people that I'm with for most of the day aren't committed to loving their neighbors in the same way that I say I'm committed to? What happens to my attitude throughout the day when I am with other people that are like that? Remember, we become like the people that we associate with. So if the people that we associate with are of a mind to ridicule this or make fun of that or whatever, it becomes increasingly difficult for me to not fit into that mold. The only way to do that is to offset that with enough exposure to people who are questioning this. How do I do this better? How do I do it differently? And that doesn't happen on a Sunday morning because there's no interaction. I might get some intellectual fodder. I might get a little nugget that I can add to my database of knowledge and understanding, but I don't really get to talk through with other people. How did you do it this week? What worked well for you? What didn't work well for you? When did you blow up this week? I can learn from your mistakes as well as your victories. So I'm convinced that if we actually want to return to a community that demonstrates love toward other people, we need to be with other people who are committed to the same process at least enough hours during the week that we can start to displace the hours of the week that we're with people who aren't committed to that. I don't know what the right ratio is, but let's say you're with, and you probably don't face this, right? You're with yourself locked up in an office all day? No?
I work with 25 women, 27 men.
Oh, my word.
I can't go back to my office, but...
See, this is why he's at Bible study on Saturday and Thursday, because he's in an Really? You have to work with them all day long? See, I thought...
Outside, but yeah, to a point.
Oh, my.
There's interaction. They fed up with me. They sent me back to my office.
He handles it well. He puts on a Tom Selleck mask and then goes for the rest of the day. Right, Jason?
Yeah. You were there.
Yeah. It is hard. It is hard. The gig that I just, you know... The guy I was working with those short months where he was just absolutely miserable, one of the most negative people I've ever met in my whole life. And I'll tell you what, you have everything that you can do to just put that lock up man and say, I can't be like this.
Well, just tell a little bit about the story so that everybody gets... Because I was going to actually use your wife's comment in a minute. Remember what she said? You told me. She said that within 2 or 3 days of the time that you weren't there anymore, she could notice the difference. Well, just go ahead and give everybody...
It was a negative situation. You know, things were slow. Get a job. It was just... I'm not going to say where or who, but it was just pretty toxic. And I just said that this is enough of this. I'm not doing this anymore. You know, things were slow. I had to take a job that I thought was going to last. And I said, this is just absolutely toxic. And the people, it just wasn't happening. I mean, there was no, you know, hey, good morning, how's it going, man? I hope you had a good day. How was your weekend? None of that. I mean, just none of that. And I'm not that kind of guy. And the one guy that I work with, whose father is quite well off and has a couple of businesses going, man, I can't wait till my old man dies, because when I get his money, I'm out of here. And I'm thinking to myself, what kind of relationship is this? And it just got to the point where it was really starting to wear me down. And I finally said, you know, I've got to start taking care of my mom's estate on the end of July, because things are happening a little bit quicker than we thought after my mom passed. We're going to be cleaning out the house. To make a long story short, all kinds of paperwork and there's inheritance and all this other stuff. And they said, well, since it's going to be July, you might as well. Work was very, very slow. There's hardly any work for two guys, but only three. They said, you might as well just can today. And I looked up and I said, thank you, Jesus, because it was just toxic and it was just absolutely wearing me down. I did not want to be there. I was nice to everybody, you know, but the guys were cursing in front of the women and they were working there, and it was just a whole thing. So, and my wife said, man, she said, 2 or 3 days out of this thing, boy, did I notice a change in you. She said, you're getting back to your old self. And it does wear you down as much as you try to keep positive and everything, man.
Forget the specifics of the story and remember his wife's comment. There's a woman who knows you pretty well, and she says, I may not have noticed the gradual change. This is important. I may not have noticed the gradual change over 6 months' time as you were more and more and more and more immersed in the culture. But as soon as you came out of the toxic culture, within days I started to notice a different you.
Yeah.
And if that's something that your wife notices... I wonder if it isn't true that we don't notice the change in our own lives. In other words, if I'm immersed in this toxic culture, and not all workplaces are toxic by any means, but if I start to absorb little things a day at a time, and I work in a place or any place for years, I'm going to start to become like that. What do we need to do to offset that on a regular basis? So the one thing is, groups like this, where we have discussions and we actually share these stories. Here's another one. I'm going to just read this out of Galatians. Do not be deceived. God cannot be mocked. A man reaps what he sows. The one who sows to please his sinful nature, from that nature will reap destruction. one who sows to please the Spirit from the Spirit will reap eternal life. Let's not become weary in doing good, for at the proper time we will reap a harvest if we do not give up. And then we get to this verse that Jim was alluding to earlier. Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all people, especially those who belong to the family of believers. All right, so the assumption there, first off, is that if you're a believer at the time when that's written, you're probably going to be experiencing difficulty. Because to be a follower of the way at that time was to be an outcast. We're starting to experience that a little bit more today. But to be a follower of the way was to be an outcast. And so to show special favor to those who were other believers was actually to meet their needs and care for them because nobody else in culture might be doing that.
We don't face what the people that believe in China face.
Oh, certainly not.
What's that? Sorry.
But that is the kind of an environment that this would have been speaking to. That you and I might be the only life source that these other believers have in a case like that. But so point one, spend time with other people. Do you have somebody like you? The three of us got together last night, and that's why I love conversations like that. Once you get beyond the how are you and all that stuff, to have some real deep discussions where you can challenge each other. Where the differences actually help. We don't see things the same way, we don't understand life the same way, but by the end of an evening of discussion with other people who are committed to growing in love, they're going to rub off on me and I'm going to rub off on them, hopefully all in good ways. The next one. Sow what you want so that you'll have, sow what you know you should so that you're going to harvest the right thing later. Well, so do you have a plan for how you're going to love? So some acts of love just come up perchance, we'll say. Whether you call it a divine appointment that God has orchestrated things so that you're going to be in the right place at the right time, or whether you're just there and you have a chance to be God's ambassador at that moment. There's things that just happen in your day. But do you have an intentional plan for people that you're going to love and ways that you're going to love? So, Scott, today, right? It's a great story. It's worth telling. So, Scott Baker, down in Delaware today at a friend's place. I guess you know the fellow, right?
Jim, yeah, I've known Jim for several years. Scott used to work with this guy. He's known him since they were like 6 or 7 years old. And the guy's got cancer now. Started a business. And he was doing chemo and everything like that, and he really didn't want any visitors. And Scott just said, you know what, this morning, he says, I'm going to leave at 3 o'clock or 3:30 this morning, and I'm going to go down there, and I'm going to surprise him if he needs help during his landscaping business. Because he is working it a little bit, even though he's got the case. He says, I'm going to help him out today. But I'm going to just show up. He says, because if I call and say I'm coming, he's going to say, no, I don't want any visitors at all. But he said, he just headed down there this morning at 3 o'clock, 3:30, and he's probably surprised Jim by now, and he's probably working with him. And that's just what you do. And it's hard to find guys like that. And Scott and I have known each other since 88. He was managing Radio Shack down here before they
were. Yeah. So
it's just
everybody's story is going to look different, but I love to hear other people's stories of how they've intentionally helped others because it gives me ideas. It inspires me, and it gives me new ideas.
I think it becomes automatic, Glenn. You know, if you think about it, I did a sermon one day in a church, and I said, you know, I said, if Jesus was out there with a flat tire, then would you stop and help him? Or would you just drive on by? And lo and behold, I'm on the way home from the church, and I get to the top of the hill where you can turn left off to Lehigh University, where their observatory is. There's a lady broken down in the middle lane. I said, well, Dancy, I said, if you don't stop, you're the biggest jackass in the world. And I had to pull up behind her. I said, well, I've just preached this, and what am I going to do? Drive by. So I stopped, and the cops came, and they, you know, got behind her, and everything was fine, and she got her car. But I'm thinking to myself, Well, here's a perfect example. And if I drive by her, I'm just the biggest jerk. You know, so you, I think we, if we just, as we go about our daily routine, if we're just on the lookout for stuff like that, you can just affect anybody that you come across. I don't think you have to go out there with a plan. I think the plan is to just be observant. And if you see somebody that needs something, just help.
And yet, as we've said, you can't stop for every flat tire. You can't stop for every situation. And so this is why I said I believe you actually do need a plan. Because if you can't be everywhere to help people... Okay, so one of the illustrations I used about my own life before is like I would always be perplexed about, should I give money to this guy who's got the little cup and the cardboard sign at the intersection, right? Homeless, hungry, right? And you're never quite sure, is he really homeless and hungry, or does he just need another fifth of liquor, or does he just not feel like getting a job, or whatever? And I know some people have the idea, well, just give him some money, right? And then it's God's responsibility as to how he uses it. And I get that. I don't travel with cash. I'm certainly not going to put my credit card in the cup. And it turns out that most of them aren't sophisticated enough that they don't have the little card readers on their phones so that they can't take my credit card for a charitable donation.
You admit too.
And so there are actually times when, no kidding, this I did this a couple of times, where I drove down the road to a local ATM and got some cash, and by the time I got back, the guy'd be gone, and I thought, that's it, I'm tired of this, this is ridiculous. I remember one time I did that, and it took me 20 minutes. You ever made a right turn thinking you were going to be able to make four right turns and get back where you started, and it didn't work that way? Right? 20 minutes later, you're still trying to find your way out of that first right turn? Well, so I just made up my mind that there were certain things that I would give to regularly that would offset that. That's just my solution. Everybody has to have their own solution to things. But when you find yourself disappointed with your performance, ask yourself what you would do in the future that would be different. With this recognition, I don't think loving other people is natural, so we should not be surprised when we're bad at it. I mean, I know that doesn't sound right, but I think we should just not be shocked when we're bad at it. We should accept the fact that we're really amateurs a lot of times at loving other people and just learn from our mistakes and say, if I want to be better next year at loving other people, I need to start today to think through what I'd do differently.
Don't you think it's an ongoing process?
Yeah.
I mean, it's never, you're never just going to get to that point where, oh, man, I'm just, loving every day. I think it's a learning experience, too.
Humans are selfish by nature.
Which means you're going to tend to revert back to your normal selfish way.
Yeah, but if you catch yourself, I think that's part of then you're learning and you're growing. Like, you know, I just act like a jerk. Learn from it. And just before, we're not God or whatever, or senior relationship with God, you've just done your thing, got pissed off, and now you can get a second thought.
It's the Holy Spirit.
Yes.
Convicting you.
Yes.
Which makes for a nice segue, Jason, thank you, into the one thing that we didn't take care of yet. That would be on the top of the back side of your paper. John 15:7. I'm sure most of us have read this a number of times, but I just want to do a little quick diagram about it. If you remain in me and my words remain in you, ask whatever you wish, and it will be done for you. So there's actually three things going on. So this center, or this, not the center, the middle circle, let's call it that, represents me or you or anybody. And what Jesus said is, if you remain in me, that's if this second circle remains inside Jesus, that's half the equation. What's the other half? Look at the verse. Look at the verse. What's missing? Us is there. Jesus is there. There's one final thing. All right. When the Word of God is in me and I am in Jesus, what's Jesus able to do? use the word that is already in me to guide me. So if there's none of His word in me, He doesn't have as much opportunity to guide me regularly because there's no mental references. Look at what this verse from Psalm says. Deep calls to deep and the roar of waterfalls. All your waves and breakers have swept over me. This is deep right here calling to deep. This is Jesus, who I've chosen to remain in, being able to guide me through the words that I have studied that are His, and through those words He's able to move me as He wants to throughout life. In other words, I don't have to constantly ask, I wonder what I should do. I wonder what I should do in this situation. And in that way, deep calls to deep. And it's interesting, look at the description here. In the roar of the waterfalls, your waves break over me. So in other words, in the middle of the chaos and the turmoil that is your day, God has a way to guide you if you put enough of His word into you so that He has something that He can use to leverage you. That's pretty much it. So those are the three things that I thought were helpful there. Right? We need to get together with people so that we can learn how to interact with each other, share our successes. We need to go out and intentionally practice love, think about how to do it better tomorrow than we did today. And we need to immerse ourselves enough in the Word so that we can be able to be in a position internally to be influenced by God more tomorrow than we were today. That's it. That's all I got for you today. I'm sorry.